From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, name after name after name, we talk with former fire commissioner for New York City, Thomas Van Essen, about his experiences on September 11th. He led the department that day when they lost 343 men. He has a new memoir. Also, we talk about the origins of some Grateful Dead songs with Dennis McNally. He was the band's publicist and official historian. He has a new inside history of the band, A Long Strange Trip. And a child's view of the era of drugs, free love, and rock and roll. We talk with Joelle Frazier about her new memoir, Growing Up the Daughter of Beatniks in California in the 60s and 70s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. My guest is former New York City Fire Commissioner Thomas Van Essen. He led the fire department in its response to the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th and oversaw the department's rescue and recovery efforts at Ground Zero. In the process of helping to save more than 25,000 lives, 343 firefighters died. While the firefighters have been celebrated as heroes since that day, the New York City Fire Department has been criticized for its communication and coordination problems on 9/11. After 31 years as a firefighter, including 3 years as president of the Firefighters Union, Thomas Van Essen retired from his post as commissioner in December. He's written a memoir of his time with the fire department. It's called Strong of Heart. We spoke yesterday about his experience of September 11th. Where were you when the first tower collapsed?
I had just left the command post across the street where everybody had set up and was walking up Church Street. And I thought part of the building collapsed. The amount of dust and debris that just blew over us was like being in an earthquake or a volcano or something. Just really got dark. It just ducked into a building, let that wave of dirt and dust and concrete blow over us. And when we came out, I thought for sure that part of it had fallen. I still didn't believe that the whole building would fall.
You know, firefighters put out fires. I mean, that's always the end in sight. But after the second tower fell, was there a point in which you knew this is not going to happen? We're not going to put this. This is no longer just a fire. And what did the new objective become?
Well, we knew way before either tower fell that we weren't going to put the fire out, that our mission was strictly to get up as fast and as far as we could, get as many people out, and we did. We got out more than 20,000 people. I mean, from different levels, from 7 floors underground to 70 floors above ground, we really did assist thousands and thousands of people, which is something that everybody has to remember, that those lives weren't in vain, that they helped rescue and save thousands of people.
How did September 11th end for you that day? Where were you at the end of the day? When did your day end?
Well, it didn't end, I guess, maybe till about 3 o'clock the next morning. We had meetings all day. We had gone back down to the site in between the meetings. I had been down there 2 or 3 times. And then after the last meeting, late at night, I went down there and I was walking around. And, it was just horrible.
What did you see? What did it look like?
It was, a mass of humanity trying in ways that they just couldn't do what they wanted to do. The firefighters and the volunteers just tried to do superhuman things and lift things and lift pieces of debris and steel and crawl into areas where they thought maybe somebody might be trapped. Crawling into deep, dark caverns and tunnels, taking enormous risks. And we were trying to get enough lights, and the overpass had fallen. We couldn't really get heavy equipment in. Welders and steel workers are coming from everywhere and just offering to help. And no questions asked. The support from everybody was really something to see, and it just kept coming.
During the day, did you get confirmation of by name of individuals that you knew that had died?
Yes, we started to get confirmation about individual names, and confirmed that they were dead early in the afternoon.
And who close to you?
The first one we got was Father Judge, who was one of our chaplains, who was just a great guy, and we had become very close. He baptized my granddaughter. He was set to baptize my second granddaughter. My first grandson, my son named after him, Mason Judge. He was just a wonderful guy. And everybody loved him. And he was the first person that they carried out. He was in the North Tower, actually. And it just began the process of name after name after name after name that just kept coming, you know, for days. And, you know, just horrible.
At that first press conference that was held after September 11th, you were standing next to the mayor and you were asked the question, can you talk about the loss to the department? And you gave a really very eloquent and heartfelt answer. Can you give us an idea what was going through your mind then?
Well, I guess I was three quarters numb at that point, just thinking about how many people were going to be lost. You know, just the idea that we had no real confirmation of the total numbers, so we were estimating it. We said over 200, and I thought it would be closer to 400, thinking about how many people were in there. But I was really hoping that a lot of people would be found alive that day and the next day and, you know, for a couple of days as we went forward. But then we had meetings with collapse experts that night and the next night, and they told us, you're not going to find anybody alive because of that weight going from 1,340 feet to 80 feet of rubble. They said the weight and the pressure would be just too much and that nobody would survive. And they were right. They were wrong about us finding, you know, full bodies. We did. We found reasonably complete torsos way into it, probably because of bunker gear, but not with the civilians that didn't have that protection and not that many people. But that afternoon, all I could think of was, you know, normally, when we lose one firefighter, or two, or three, it's like a worst nightmare. We had just had Father's Day, which is our worst nightmare. Three guys dying, you know, and I thought, like, wow, how could God do this to us? You know, only a couple of months to go in the administration. I thought, wow, really gave us a good smack on the way out and not having any conception of what was going to happen in September and that the losses would be really too many to even comprehend.
Father's Day was a devastating fire in which you lost three of your men.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have explained that. There was an explosion in a hardware store, and we lost three firefighters.
Now, one of your jobs as commissioner in the best of times is and the worst is to console the families of the fallen. And in the case of September 11th, you were also consoling the firefighters who survived. And were looking for their men. Was that something that always came naturally to you, or was it the part of the job that you felt was the hardest, or perhaps you never mastered?
I don't know if anybody ever masters it. If they do, I salute them. I found it to be the hardest part, the most painful part, and the part you just you hope never happen. But this tragedy was overwhelming in that respect because you couldn't do what you normally did. At Father's Day, I had gotten close to those three ladies, had gone to lunch with them and spent the whole day with them, had gone to all the wakes a couple of nights and gone to the funerals and had conversations with them and just tried in a small way to make their life just, you know, give a little less pain, you know, a little more help to them. So that was what we did. Myself and I had a team of people who were very compassionate and really cared about families.
Among them, I imagine, Father Michael Judge.
Well, the judge was the leader of that team. He was just phenomenal as far as giving people a minute of... He seemed to suck their pain in, you know, to take it away from them and to take it himself. And he was much better at that than I was. I would always be standing there. I would never, you know, not do it, but I always didn't think I was good at it because it was very emotional for me. I always felt as if these guys were my kids or my brothers, and I always felt that it was a personal loss for me, and dealing with their mothers or wives or their kids was just horrible. So that was always the worst, absolute, no question about it, part of the job. But when September 11th hit, we weren't able to do that. In addition to the fact that it happened and that you wanted to do that, you couldn't. There was just too many.
Thomas von Essen is my guest. He's the former fire commissioner of New York City. He headed the department during the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and the months afterwards. His memoir of his experiences with the New York Fire Department is Strong of Heart. We'll continue our conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is former New York City Fire Commissioner Thomas von Essen. He led the department throughout the World Trade Center attack and much of the rescue and recovery efforts. He has a new memoir about that time and his life as a firefighter. It's called Strong of Heart. I'd like to talk about the recovery effort. The firefighters and the police and everyone involved evidenced amazing courage and morale at the site, but I'm sure it's inevitable that morale must have had lapses or flagged at different points. What conflicts did the firefighters face during the recovery? What did you find challenging about that phase of the operation?
Immediately, they were upset because we were holding them back. The chiefs, that those first 5-6 hours, first of all, we lost our senior command, so now we had some chiefs came in from home and took charge. They had to get a sense of what was necessary. And we had some excellent chiefs that stepped up at that time and did that, Chief Carruthers and Chief Fellini, people who had been at home and came in and fortunately had their heads on straight and were able to function. So it was difficult, but they did it. But a lot of the firefighters, not understanding the whole picture, would be upset because, you know, we've got to get in there. The brothers are trapped. We've got to get in there. Well, the chiefs at the scene would say that we have to get control. That building right there is still burning. It's going to collapse. So we had to wait until that collapse of other buildings fell so we could ascertain the danger to putting additional people, live people, in harm's way in an area that chances were slim we were going to rescue people, but we wanted to make those efforts. So that you have your first day. And then that night and the second day, enormous numbers of people came from everywhere. People that meant well. Volunteers that went from 16 to 80. And you weren't sure of their ability. You weren't sure if they had any clue what they were doing. You weren't sure if they had any skills, if they were going to get hurt, so you had to worry about that. USAR teams started coming in, urban search and rescue teams. They were phenomenal. The skill level, the ability to just give them a job and not worry about them anymore was something that the chiefs in charge really appreciated. So that was a good thing. Then you had people come from other departments, Chicago, Boston, Phoenix, people who really knew their stuff, so you could give them assignments. Now you'd give them a job, and then you'd have some of our guys upset because why would you give a job to the USAR team when such and such a truck from Staten Island could do it? Well, the chiefs had reasons for doing different things. So there were all of those morale issues and issues of then people being tired. People want to work. They don't want to go home, but people only can work so long, and they become a hazard. You have to worry about them hurting themselves. You have to worry about them hurting somebody else. You have to worry about them not being effective because they are so tired and they've lost their strength. So they had all those issues, the logistical issues, that we were outside of the area trying to figure out solutions, getting people there, feeding them, getting them equipment. We lost all of our equipment in the tragedy. Everybody had every piece of equipment that was on the trucks was all destroyed. So we had to get all new equipment. We needed tools, hand tools, power tools. They needed cutting tools. The welders came in, the steel workers came in, the iron workers, concrete people, heavy equipment, bulldozers. It just went on and on and on. It was a monumental project, and it was everybody did a great job. They really did. No matter what area you talk to, even Everybody put any problems they had, they put them aside and just went to work. But morale, you know, and issues and stress started to hit after a couple of days. Now you realize, well, I'm not going to rescue my friend. He's going to be dead when I find him. And a few more days go by, and now you're thinking you might not even find your friend. Then you pull out a body that's totally destroyed, and you say, if I find my friend, I might not be able to even recognize him. And then you start dealing with the families, and the families are concerned that if you find my husband or my son, what did you find? So it just, that's very stressful. And that took a lot out of people, and that made people very edgy. And then, you know, how should we work? 24 hours on, 12 hours on, 24 hours off. It just, it was a lot of stuff.
The fire department has come under scrutiny and at times attack since September 11th for alleged failures in the department's response. A draft report by an independent consultant has targeted a number of problems in the fire department's response on that day, and perhaps first among them were radio communication problems. Could you help us understand that? I read in the report that the fire department was using 10 or 15-year-old radios and that the department suffered a collapse of communications far exceeding any other agency on that day.
Well, the radio is pretty complicated, but we start off by saying that there were no breakdowns in the fire department's response that day. And the report is what I guess most management reports do, find things to select and criticize. They criticize the discipline of the firefighters, and I say to you that if we listened to their report, we would be giving people disciplinary charges for running up 40 flights of stairs and saving somebody's mother. So these were heroic acts, and if the department thinks they should change policies, that's okay, change the policies, but they should absolutely stay away from criticizing heroism of people that are on the scene that day. The radios are a different issue. The radios are, it has not been honestly reported since day one. We had issues with new radios. They're right, those radios in place are 10 years old, which isn't unusual. There's probably radios 15 and 20 years old being used throughout the country. What you don't hear anybody say is no one stands up in front of a camera and says, I have a better radio. I have a radio that works in high-rise sub-basements. I have a radio that will transmit from the first floor of the Trade Center to the 50th floor of the Trade Center. No radios work without repeaters. It's obvious now that the repeater was working that day, that there was communication, that many people did have radio contact. There is a question, I think, and I think it's valid, that many people weren't able to communicate. Why some people weren't on that channel that was being going through the repeater, which is like a booster. It takes a signal and increases it, so it allows you to get up to the 50th or 60th floor. And the normal radio is probably going to work 10, 20 floors, depending on where and the amount of steel and everything else. So there's, you know, if people want to really look at the radios, they should look at it. They should bring people in. They should sit down and they should really investigate the radio situation. There's an awful lot of misinformation and dishonesty being going on with it, I think.
Do you have recommendations for how better to train fire department firefighters for this kind of multiple phase emergency situation?
Well, I don't know what else we could have done. We've been training more than FDNY has in the last 20 years. We've trained more in the last 5 years. Training is important. You've got to keep it up. There's new things to learn. They should be thinking about anthrax and biological terrorism. But they did a great job in that building that day. They know what to do when they get into these buildings. They know how to handle it. There was breakdowns in the staging and breakdowns in some of the coordination amongst the troops themselves. That happens. This was the worst tragedy that ever hit our nation. I mean, do you think to sit down now and criticize some breakdowns in that effort without always constantly reinforcing the unbelievable heroism of people running up 50 flights of stairs, totally exhausted, to help people who might be trapped in a stairwell. I think it's kind of sad, and people should be ashamed of themselves and with some of the criticism. The radio stuff, fine. Have an investigation and put people under oath and find out what happened. I asked for an investigation, an independent investigation, because I didn't think that the fire department could really honestly evaluate itself. They don't have accountability at the highest levels of the uniform management. I asked for an independent investigation last October. While I was there, I think it's important to investigate, not to even find fault and find blame, but to find out what happened so you can prevent it from happening again.
Thomas Van Essen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thomas Van Essen is New York City's former fire commissioner. His new memoir is Strong of Heart. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By the State of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at vermontvacation.com. And from Vintage Books, publishers of The Dying Animal, the new paperback by Philip Roth, author of American Pastoral. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On your love light, let it shine on me. Hey, let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.
Coming up, the 60s remembered. We talk about the Grateful Dead with the band's publicist, Dennis McNally. He has a new inside history of the band. Also, we hear a child's view of life in the 60s. Joelle Frazier was the daughter of beatniks. She grew up surrounded by drugs, music, and chaos. She has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. The music of the Grateful Dead was the soundtrack for the psychedelic scene in San Francisco in the 60s. The band's experimental, spontaneous music and philosophy became a lifestyle for thousands of fans throughout the 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. In 1995, Jerry Garcia, the lead guitarist, vocalist, and spiritual heart of the band, died, and with him, the Grateful Dead ceased to exist. But the remaining members have formed their own bands. Last weekend in Wisconsin, they all reunited to play a concert under the name The Other Ones, and now they're planning a fall tour. The band's longtime publicist, Dennis McNally, has just published a history of the Dead called A Long, Strange Trip. McNally, a historian, is also the author of a best-selling biography of Jack Kerouac. One of the things McNally explores in the book is the enduring and prolific songwriting partnership between Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter. According to McNally, by the late 70s, the two men had become so in tune with each other, they'd be struck with moments of mutual inspiration, which happened when they wrote this song from Terrapin Station.
Seem familiar. Shadows of the sailor forming winds both foul and fair all swarm. Down in Carlisle he loved a lady many years ago. There's a Grateful Dead song that's very beloved called Terrapin Station, and Jerry got the idea for it driving across the bridge to Marin County from the East Bay. Got home, you know, felt the notes in his head and went, "Oh wow, this is a good one. This is a keeper." Immediately, you know, ran out of the car when he got home, ran to a tape recorder, picked up a guitar, and laid down the notes so he wouldn't forget. Simultaneously, because it was a stormy day, simultaneously, Hunter, about 3 miles away, looking at the bridge. This is a little spooky, but I mean, it's a true story. Looking at the bridge, got inspired, wrote what was about 10 pages of lyrics. The next day, Garcia went over to Hunter's and said, "I've got this great new song." And Hunter said, "So do I." Jerry took page 1, 2, and 10. Lyrics, you know, it's a limit to how many lyrics you can put to a song. And bingo, they had Terrapin Station.
It seems as if the Dead discovered electricity and LSD at the same time. And one of the stories I enjoyed in the book was about how the Dead were introduced to LSD by the CIA. Now, help me wrap my head around that one, please.
It's a great concept, isn't it? The CIA, in a program called MKUltra, experimented quite frequently and really horribly with unsuspecting people, but also with people who knew they were getting a psychedelic drug. Throughout the late 50s and early 60s, and they did it, among other places, at VA hospitals. And the first person in the Grateful Dead scene to receive LSD, as well as other psychedelic drugs, was Robert Hunter. So did Ken Kesey, for example, participate in this program at the Menlo Park VA hospital in the Palo Alto area. Jerry and the other members of that scene got it more casually and more informally. And it's interesting because it was in early 1965, in the wake of the Rolling Stones, they had started to play electric instruments late in 1964 and created this band called the Warlocks. And they'd been rehearsing for a little while. And it's a nice synchronous event because it's very, very close in time. There is some kind of primal connection between LSD and electricity. LSD electrifies your life, one might say. And in April of 1965, just before the Warlocks played in public for the first time, someone turned on Jerry to LSD, and he and his wife took it and had a marvelous day. And as Jerry said, you know, "Gee, this is, I didn't know it before, but this is what I've been looking for all along." And there was no turning back at that point.
The Dead's first incarnation as a rock band was the Warlocks. Let's play a cut from a 1965 Warlock demo for Autumn Records. The song is Mindbender, and this is from the Grateful Dead box set, The Golden Road. Thank you. And that was the first incarnation of the Grateful Dead, the Warlocks. My guest is Dennis McNally, author of A New History of the Grateful Dead. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis McNally. Since 1984, he's worked as the Grateful Dead's head publicist. He has a new book about the history of the Grateful Dead called A Long Strange Trip. Can we talk about space now? could you perhaps put space to rest for us? Some people hate it. Some people love it. And for the few people who don't know what I'm talking about, that's a long improvisational period and that always comes up in every Grateful Dead concert. During which some people choose to use the restrooms.
Think Cecil Taylor's wild, you know, or Ornette Coleman or Archie Shepp's most creative outbursts, but louder, much, much louder. The time called space, which usually was done without drums, frequently done at least at the beginning without drums, so that you've just got guitars and keyboards, perhaps, was John Cage, but loud. It was music that had necessarily no beat, not necessarily conventional notes. It was absolutely new each time, and was there. It was sort of the heir to the acid test because it was trying to create something that literally would be never heard again. For me, it's some of the finest and most interesting stuff they ever did.
So you loved it as a listener?
Every time.
Uh-huh.
However strange, because there were no limits. Even when it was boring, and I'm not saying it wasn't at times, the very fact that they tried is the essential fact. The Grateful Dead, when they play space, they are doing, what's at their core, what's at their heart. And you're right, a lot of people, and certainly almost everybody who isn't a hardcore Deadhead, don't like it. But as I say, that's almost the point.
Oh, that's really the thing. I mean, you could say of most music, you either get it or you don't, but it seems so much more true of the Grateful Dead.
the challenges were more extreme because it demanded an active participation. John Perelis wrote that in the Times, and I was very, very pleased because John's a very good and sober and intelligent critic, and I felt, he gets it. Well, and he also, I might add, got Grateful Dead music, but the point was, you're not being entertained. You are a partner in this, and if you aren't willing to be a partner, if you're just sitting there passively saying, "Amuse me," you won't get it.
You've been following the Dead now for what, more than 20 years, and your original idea was to trace the line from the Beat Generation to the Dead. What do you feel that you've come up with at the end of 20 years?
Outside of a consistency of the social approach, which is to say anti-materialism, a kind of environmental attitude that almost all the band members have contributed to, the basic idea relates to the idea of improvisation, Kerouac, what Allen Ginsberg called spontaneous bop prosody, which wasn't quite literally 100% improvisational, but remarkably close to it. And what Kerouac did with writing, the Grateful Dead did with music, because although they used the elements of rock and roll, the instruments and electricity and a backbeat, they introduced into this mix elements of jazz intellectually and improvisationally that there are other bands that jam, but nobody ever quite fused the two together, for my money, the way the Grateful Dead did.
Can you think of a song from a live performance that most exemplifies that?
Well, ultimately, Dark Star is the song that it was a vehicle And it was simply post, you know, markings, and which you went from place to place, but in between, you could go anywhere.
Let's listen to Dark Star. This is Dark Star from The Live Dead. Dark Star by the Grateful Dead. Dennis McNally's new History of the Dead is called A Long, Strange Trip. Joelle Frazier was born in San Francisco in 1966. Her parents were young bohemians who had dreams of being writers, but the drink, drugs, and parties of the era got in the way of their ambitions. Frazier's parents split a couple years after she was born. While her mother worked, 2-year-old Joelle was left with her Aunt Kathy, a free spirit who lived on a houseboat in Sausalito. Joelle Frazier has written a memoir of her hippie childhood called The Territory of Men. Frazier's mother ended up living with several men, one who abused Joelle. Now her mother is a therapist, and the two women are very close. Joelle Frazier begins her book with an oft-told story in their family, the trip to the hospital for her birth.
Mother's Day, 1966. Watch us as we barrel across that bright bridge toward San Francisco, the gray waves of the ocean seething and crashing below. It's a warm May day, the windows are wide open, and my mother's black hair flies wildly around her sweating face. We're late for the hospital, but traffic is light, and this is a party after all, one that began in the morning and lasted all night and hasn't stopped for years. In the back seat, my father sits between two friends, smoking a cigarette, lips stained dark from gin and grape juice. He grins at my mother in front, tells her to hold on. He says, wouldn't it be a great story if they had a baby on the Golden Gate Bridge? The Mamas and the Papas' California Dreamin' comes on the radio, and everyone sings, the words swept up by scarves of fog and spread over the sea. They're drunk, all of them, all but my mother, who leans back to ease the pain, belly swollen, legs braced, because it's almost time and I'm pushing to get out.
That's Joelle Frazier reading from her memoir, The Territory of Men. Joelle, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, it's so perfect that California Dreamin' was playing on the radio. Obviously, this is not one of your memories. Was this a story your mother always told you?
Yes, it's a notorious story in the family that I was almost born on the Golden Gate Bridge. They had left a party. And they said, oh, it's time, she's going to have the baby, let's go. And everyone wanted to pile into the car and be, you know, the party just kept going wherever you were. So, and this was a wonderful thing to celebrate, of course.
Your mom lived in Sausalito in California after she left your dad and worked at a TV station. And you write that she used to leave you with your aunt, that your aunt, her sister, a very young sister, was her babysitter. And you have this image of your mother lowering you down in a basket to your sister who lived on a houseboat in Sausalito.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very famous houseboat area. It's called Gate 5, and they were just these broken ships, just, you know, with missing planks and no railings, and it was just this wild place. And that's where Kathy lived. She lived on a houseboat, and it was called The Love. And it was hard to get there. You had to, you know, you had to go. There was a map. You had to climb over ferries and over roofs to get there. And that's where I spent my days when I was 2, 3, 4 years old.
So what was life like with your aunt on the Love?
On the Love, it was it was a party. That was where people played music. The musicians would hang out with Kathy there, and people would get stoned and play guitars. And sometimes I would get an instrument like a tambourine or something like that, and I would play along. It was just full of music and rock and roll and lots of pot. Sometimes if the musicians weren't playing, they would play records. So music was the event. That was sort of a concert atmosphere. That was why people gathered.
So this is 68, 69. Did she go to the Fillmore? Was she attending the acid tests, the Kankakee, the Mary Pranksters happenings?
Yeah, she went to all that stuff. She was always backstage. She was very beautiful, and she was kind of, I wouldn't call her a groupie, but that's the closest term that comes to mind. She had a lot of boyfriends at Quicksilver and Santana and people like that. And so I was usually part of that as a child.
How'd they treat you as a kid? Did they give you, little hits from their reefer, or treat you a little adult or what?
Yes, I was treated like a mini adult. All the kids were. In fact, I think it was considered rude to tell us what to do, to tell us to go to bed. I also think that, they were in their early 20s, and for many of them, having grown up in the 50s as kids, where they were told what to do all the time, this was a time when they could relive their childhood. And so to have me around as a four-year-old was a way to be childlike again. So it was almost as if we were all children together, even as they were treating me like an adult. It's kind of a paradox, but we were children and we were adults all at the same time, and there was no distinction between me and them. I smoked pot just like they did. My aunt was very proud of the way I could take a hit with a roach, just like the adults.
I think,
at three.
Another scene from your book that really got me was that when you were just a toddler, I think you were maybe 3 years old, your mom would send you off to the 7-Eleven with a list of groceries. Milk or bread, Marlboros. She literally sent you around the corner for a pack of cigs alone. How did you even know?
Across the street.
How did you even know what was on the list? You couldn't read.
I couldn't read, but she would point, over there. I knew 7-Eleven was across the street and down the little way, and the clerk knew me. And I would just hand her the list, and she'd gather the groceries for me, and I would haul them back across the street. And it wasn't because my mother was lazy. I think she just wanted me to think for myself and be enterprising. And as I said, I was treated like a little adult. So I waddled across the street with the cigarettes and the peanut butter. And it's a funny story.
She also let you sell your paintings on the street by yourself. Were you scared?
No. When I did that, I was 6 years old. I sold those watercolor paintings for 50 cents a piece. And on Bridgeway in Sausalito, this was like Woodstock every day. I mean, it was nuts. And I loved it. I was part of this scene. I was one of the folks and carrying my little rolled up paintings. But then one day a man pulled me aside, and it became a very sad memory for me. In fact, that's one of the most vivid memories I have of my childhood, was being pulled aside by that man into that stairwell that I wrote about. And that's a sad thing, but in writing about it, it transformed it for me. And it's not just a painful memory anymore. It's something else now.
He pulled you aside and molested you.
Yes. So that summer was beautiful, though. I mean, up until that happened, I loved it. And after that happened, I never went back and I never painted again. So it's sad. It's bittersweet because I had the 2 months of selling my paintings and walking around. My mother was up at home somewhere, but then that happened.
That's my impression of a lot of the stories in your book. They have both sides. You could appreciate the freedom you were given, or just this amazing experience of going along on your parents', your mother's spiritual journey, or journey through the 60s, but it also had a scary underside.
It had its price. There was the freedom and there was the price.
What contact did you have with your biological father?
I used to see him every year. He lived in Hawaii most of the time, and I used to visit him once a year, and that was always just this great respite and sanctuary to go over there, and I would just play on the beach all day, and that's how I saw him.
And what was he by trade?
Oh, he was a writer. That's what he wanted to be. But my dad did all kinds of jobs. He could never keep a job for more than a year. I can't even tell you what he did. He just worked whatever. He'd work at a golf shop. He'd do insurance. He'd bartend. Just whatever he could to make some money. He drove a taxi.
And he drank.
and he drank and he drank and he drank himself to death.
Did you ever live with him?
Yes, I lived with him for 1 year in Washington, and that was a hard year. He drank a lot that year. There was something about the writing. He was trying to write a novel, and the writing kept him drinking because it was so hard for him to write, I think. Even though he was good, it was hard. And so he drank, and we eventually got evicted. I got pulled out of school because he couldn't pay the rent.
Did he ever finish his novel?
He did. It's called Gone to Maui, published in 83, and it's a cult classic in Hawaii now. My brother teaches it in the high school there, and the locals like it because it's a local book and has pidgin English in it. And so it's amazing that it still lives on, that his book lives on.
Joel Frazier's new memoir is The Territory of Men. We'll continue our conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with writer Joel Frazier. Her new memoir is The Territory of Men. Both your parents drank one time or another. I think your mother was in AA and she became sober. And
yes,
she's been sober.
I was 14.
Yeah.
When I was 14, so a very long time. I am so grateful to AA. I can't say enough about it. It saved all of our lives, really.
So did you drink?
I did. I drank a lot in my 20s. I used to go to dive bars and that sort of thing. And it was where I felt close to my father because I met my father in bars. That's where we met. I would meet him for lunch in some bar and he would have, you know, 6 beers and a piece of pie and a bite of something I ate. So I was drawn to drinking. It was where I felt close to my father. And now I don't do that anymore.
Did you also do AA or was it never that serious for you?
No, I drink occasionally. I go to a program called Al-Anon, which is for friends and families of alcoholics. And that's where I make my peace with it. And I'll never be over the issues of my parents drinking, even though my mother's sober. It's formed part of who I am. To grow up the child of an alcoholic, I don't think you ever are done with it.
I have to ask, where's your Aunt Kathy now?
Well, she lives in Napa, and she's a nurse, and she has a son, and she counts hawks. She's a volunteer for the Hawk Society there and counts them in order to watch their migration patterns. It's a great volunteer society. They do a lot of to watch global warming and that kind of thing. And she's got feathers and rocks all over her house, and she camps, and she listens to the 60s, and you should just see her when the music comes on. Sometimes just tears come down her face, you know, because she lives in this tract neighborhood. It's very straight, conservative town, and it's just not where her heart is, but she's there to give her son some stability.
Did you interview Kathy for the book in your research?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I interviewed her. That's how I got some of those details. You know, at 3 years old, how would I remember some of these things?
So I interviewed both. Or your birth. I mean,
yeah, or how did I remember being in my mother's womb? Yeah, I interviewed both my mom and my Aunt Kathy, and my mom gave me her journals. She had written journals. My mother's a writer, too, a wonderful writer, and she gave me her journals from her 20s, and I actually put some of them verbatim into the book.
Yeah, I was thinking that must have been a very strange experience to read your mother's journals about what she was feeling and thinking when you were just a baby, and knowing you know the end of your story, so it's like watching your own personal train wreck, I would think.
It is. It was very sad to, because she's talking about the breakup and saying, you know, if my father, her husband, if you know, if my father didn't keep writing, if he couldn't do it, that she knew that they were going to have to break up because their lives were falling apart. He was drinking too much. And I'm watching her each day, because they're chronicled by date like a diary, and watching it get worse and worse and worse. And I just wanted to go back and rewrite it and say, you know, keep trying. Don't break up. You know, I'm only one or 2 years old. Please don't break this family up.
Well, I really appreciated talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Joelle Frazier's new memoir is The Territory of Men. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurock directs the show. Our engineer is Al Banks. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Passed along the way. Well, I got down on my knees, and I began to pray.
I began to pray.
You know the preacher like the call.
Preacher like the call.
He knows I'm gonna stay.
Knows I'm gonna stay. California,
California
dreaming of such a winter's day.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Watchers of Time, now in paperback, by Charles Todd, author of Legacy of the Dead. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
Hairspray, the new musical based on the John Waters film, is currently in previews and opens on Broadway next week. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from John Waters and the late Divine, who starred in the film. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Turn and back to the Madison.